What did you say again, Paul, about what you came through? I told you coronagraph before, but I know you did not hear me.
You're correct. I had to rewrite it. I didn't hear you, but that's the word I was looking for. So they did set up a coronagraph that allows them to cancel out the light of the star and look at the four planets left over. I'm amazed that their first light published result is a star Spadon far away, something like 1,300 light years on the large binocular telescope. Each mirror, I think they said, is 8.2 meters in diameter. That means 25-foot diameter mirrors, a pair of them. And they have managed to do a coherent combination of those two mirrors side by side, as long as it is operating at near-infrared frequency, something like 1.3 and 2.6 microns, as I remember, whereas optical frequency is around half a micron. So as you go to higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths, it becomes more difficult to combine two mirrors in a coherent manner. So that's the reason why they didn't do it at optical frequencies yet, although they're working on it. Each individual mirror, each individual two telescopes side by side of this binocular telescope, both have adaptive optics on them. So each one is correcting for the individual chunk of atmosphere that each individual telescope is looking through, and then the resultant signal of the pair is being combined as an interferometer. So therefore, they're getting the resolution of something like a 25-meter diameter mirror by using a pair of mirrors of 8 meters each. Very crafty technique. I think that is set up at Hawaii, but I'm not positive on that one. On the large binocular telescope. So LBT, large binocular telescope, first light. You Google those words and NASA, guarantee you're going to find it for them. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. I think the one I was looking at was Arizona, was the documentary. I think it was filmed in Arizona. But very good. You know, one of the documentary I saw said that they would be able to get pictures better than the Hubble, so I don't know how true that is going to be. But all the corrective optics, they correct for the any of the so-called twinkling that goes on. Pretty amazing. Very good on that, Dick. I don't know if you copied the rest of the space report, but nevertheless, all is well on the International Space Station. People on board.
I believe you were discussing that, Paul. The fact that there's a lot of pieces of space junk they got to worry about. There's also a website, I wish I could remember it, but again, if you just Google the words space junk, I think they're keeping track of something like 8,000 objects or even more, a huge number of objects they're keeping track of that are more than a couple of centimeters of diameter. 10 centimeters of diameter, I believe, is the threshold where they're keeping track of these objects. And you were telling us that I guess it was fairly recently the astronauts were got into the solar spacecraft because they knew a chunk going by, and just in case it came too close, they would have a way of dealing with the lost pressurization because of the impact.
And then it's done two other times. Very good, Dick. Very happy with all that. And, see what happens. You've got the ATV going up there. By the European Space Agency. WS.
Yeah, let me run some of this by with you one more time, Paul. It is my guess that whenever a spacewalk is required because of an external repair or replacement is needed, I think there's a pair of astronauts that go out, not just one. So you've got two in space. I think you're saying whenever there is a spacewalk, that at least one astronaut is in a Soyuz so that he could survive even if a depressurization took place. And so to have one in the Soyuz just because two are in space, I'm a little bit confused. I guess the possibility exists that a mistake was made as the two EVA astronauts go through the airlock. There was the possibility that they could doing something in the air so that you lose the pressurization rather than going through the airlock. Two questions here. Number one, isn't it usually two astronauts doing the walk? And if the space station became depressurized, I bet you there's a high probability there's no longer enough room for them to climb into a Soyuz. So if a depressurization of the space station took place, there'd be no easy way for the astronaut to climb back into the space station, climb out of his space suit in a depressurized space station, and then climb into a Soyuz. It looks like it would be a very nice situation.
Get down to 5 pounds per square inch, where the space station is the equivalent to Earth, 14.7 pounds per square inch. So they don't have that problem anymore because when they go out to Quest, but if they go out the Russian side, if the Russians, they don't have that capability, from what I understand. So when they do that, they have to have, when they had three people on board, the third person could stay in the Soyuz spacecraft. Six people on board, you don't have to do that anymore. That's old school, but this type of thing has gone on. Each astronaut has their own seat. Each seat is conformed to each body of each astronaut, so it's not like that. I'm going to run into this one. Own seat. It's unbelievable. In fact, the first thing they do, like when the shuttle used to go up, when we drop it, they used to take the tons of equipment that the shuttle would be bringing up. The first thing that would come on board after the handshake would be the new seat for the Soyuz spacecraft. They would unbolt the old seat and put the new one in there. This way, if something happens, he now has his spot to go back to Earth. There's a tremendous amount of planning that goes into all of these things that most people don't know about. There.
Fascinating. I get the impression that each chair is carefully molded to the body of a particular astronaut to give him maximum support during the high G portions of reentry. You also mentioned that the space station runs at normal pressure, 14.7 pounds per square inch. That I wasn't aware of. I know that most of our astronauts I think the system runs at something like 5 pounds per square inch at essentially pure oxygen, something pretty close to it. So the suit, I think, is at 5, and the astronaut has to go through a particular procedure to get most of the nitrogen out of his bloodstream as he goes up to some number of hours, like 6 or so hours, before he climbs into the space suit. And so I think the suit is running at 5. Space station runs at 14, and I guess the airlock has to take care of. K2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, any of the EVAs on the space station, you always have two. The way I used to remember is three numbers to remember, three pressures. Your ambient temperature, which is all we have here, 14.7 on Earth, 10 pounds and 5 pounds. For instance, the shuttle would go up, and we're going to do an EVA from the shovel, from the shuttle. What you would do is drop the pressure down to 10 pounds, kind of like split the difference between, 14.7 and 5. The astronaut would get into the spacesuit, and he would go down to 5. 5 pounds pure oxygen. Where he gets the equivalent of the amount of oxygen that you would normally get. If 14.7, you're getting 21% oxygen, getting a lot of nitrogen. Make up that difference at a 5 pound level. You do away with the nitrogen, you make it pure oxygen. So that's how they get that. And the other deal is that 14.7 pounds is standard now for the space station. It was actually standard for the space shuttle unless you were going to prepare for an EVA. And they dropped it down to 10. It would make it a lot easier for the astronauts to get into the spacesuits and adjust the pressures. Drop it. Soyuz spacecraft, what they would do is they did an EVA actually from the Soyuz spacecraft. They dropped the whole spacecraft 5 pounds.
RC5.28 lock 9 set.
Decompression chamber, decompression area. So interesting what happens though, people would sleep in the Quest overnight and yet they would be able to go into the space station for a while, eat a meal with everybody else and go back. For some reason, if you did that quick enough, you didn't have to worry about the bends or anything. So, kind of odd. But that's what they used to do. Remember that module?
Okay, you mentioned 14.7 is one pressure, 10 pounds is another pressure, 5 pounds is another pressure. The space suit runs at 5. I'm guessing maybe the Soyuz also runs at 5. Do you then drop the pressure of the whole space station from 14.7 down to 10 when an astronaut is trying to get the excess nitrogen out of his bloodstream before going down to the 5 for the spacesuit? And I'm guessing he does that for some given number of hours to get rid of the excess nitrogen in his bloodstream. Or does he go into a separate module? Does the whole space station go from 14.7 down to 10 when it are getting ready to get into a suit? Or do the two astronauts go into a particular module that goes down to 10 in order to deoxygenate and then begin to move at 5? Run that by again, number WS2N, K2LIW in the second half.
Don't make a life less, you never you heard that so loud.
the prettiest them, get them shy, says to them, stop, stop, do you like them? You wake up this morning and alive, yeah. Set them one, just them, I need a perfect compound, I got a love ring. And if them ask me, if them not like you, tell them to find the love. Get up on time, put your girls in the bar, go on.
Welcome.
Big a big jump, I'll go join the party.
Saturday. Back with your ball.
Because
the suit itself runs at 5 on pure oxygen. I'm going to guess it's something like 6 hours. Is it 6 hours? I think the quest module goes down to 5 as he climbs into the suit. Because if the room ran at 10 and the suit was running at 5, the pressure of the room would be making the suit uncomfortable against his body. It would be crushing him against his body. So I'm going to guess he spends some amount of time at 10 to get rid of nitrogen, climbs into the suit, the quest gets lowered to 5 as he closes up the suit before he actually goes EVA. Is that approximately what happens to Paul? WS2FN, K2LIW.
That's the way it is as far as I understood. Give you an idea, they used to call it camping out. You know, the two people that were going to do the EVA would go into the quest module and spend the whole night there. And it was just at 10 pounds. And then follow the crusher, get into the spacesuit, open the door, and off they go. And they don't have to bother anybody else inside the ISS.
So therefore, the whole ISS is capable of running at 14.7 continuously. So they sleep overnight at 10 to get rid of the nitrogen, and then the quest module, at coming into the suit, the quest module, I'm going to guess, goes down to 5, and it's at 5 as they're in the suit, closing up the suit, and about to go through the airlock. And when the quest module is running overnight at 10 to get rid of the nitrogen in their body, I am guessing the quest module is running at 50% oxygen instead of 21% oxygen. Is that something like what happens, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW?
I never heard that they changed the precautions. I don't know. I don't know about that. But like I said before, I probably didn't hear it, but you in the morning, you know, you would think, well, okay, it's time to go to the bathroom or whatever. They don't have a bathroom in quest. What they do is they bring the pressure back up, open the door, go back inside, eat, head to the head, come back, and depressurize again. And apparently, it's not a long enough time to, you know, to change things. So, I mean, whatever these doctors figured out on how this works out, no problem. If the time that's involved when they go back up to 14.7, it doesn't really matter. So I've always found that interesting. They come back in, close the door, and then drop it down to 5, jump into the space suit, open the door. By the way, when they open the door and they look out, they see the Earth below them, and when they burst through it, they say, wow. They feel like they're going to be jumping out of an airplane and head right down to an Earth. They say that is some feeling when you get out on it. They close the porch back to you.
I can see that. So they spend overnight in the quest module at 10 pounds, at some amount of oxygen percentage that you and I don't know about right now. Overnight, enough of the nitrogen comes out of their bloodstream. The next morning, for I guess an hour, 14 in the quest, go back into the ISS, use the head, eat a meal with the rest of the astronauts, then go back to quest, and so that hour or two that they're at ISS at 14, is not enough to put a significant amount of nitrogen back into their bloodstream, or maybe they run the whole ISS at a higher oxygen content for that period of time. I'm doubtful of that. I think that would be a little bit of a fire hazard. Although, as you know, fire in zero-G or in microgravity, a fire burns very differently. And it's, in some cases, quite a bit more easy to control. So an hour or two at ISS 14.7 after the night before at 10, and they go back into the quest, probably bring it down to 5 as they're getting into the suit. I presume the suit and EVA almost never exceed 6 hours outside. Is that approximately true? I think Story Musgrove pushed the daylights out of it and pushed it to 8 1/2 hours. But I think the suit has a safety margin if you're only out there for about 6. Is that your recollection, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, but they have recharge capability. I mean, when they're out there, they hook their space suit up and recharge themselves. You know, you can go longer. I thought it was 8. I think they got almost 8 on one of the, maybe that last Hubble mission. Yeah, no, they have a capability of recharging out there on the shuttle, probably do with the space station. But, yeah, now all these figures, the 10 pounds and 14.7, I know it's right. The 10 pounds, I'm pretty sure of. I don't know what the ratio is. And I'm sure there's some NASA people out there listening and probably saying, I know exactly what it is. You know, maybe they could email us. I think you gave out a John's email. Maybe we can get an answer on that one of these days. That's not going to be easy information to come by on the Internet.
There's something else that's bothering me, Paul. I know that Story Musgrove went to 8 1/2 hours. He used up the main supply. He was on his emergency supply of oxygen in the spacesuit when he was doing the repair of the Hubble, the main first repair. Really, he tried to do everything in one mission that was supposed to be two missions. And as he was in the airlock coming back into the space shuttle, even the emergency oxygen ran out, and he reconnected the hose between his suit and the emergency hose, I'm going to call it, in the docking module, the airlock. Now, you say recharge. The actual oxygen bottle on board is compressed oxygen. I don't think you can recharge that with an external hose. You can hook up to an external hose in order to run your suit continuously. If your main oxygen and backup oxygen, your emergency, are exhausted, and you can run that with a hose. But I don't think you can recharge the tanks of oxygen that are in the spacesuit by way of an external hose. Am I wrong on that one, Paul? I don't think you can. You can have emergency air supply, but I don't think you can recharge the tanks in that manner, unless there's a high pressure hose, and that would be a very fancy fitting. And to use that fitting while in an outside space environment with a glove on, I think there's a number of ways you can get in trouble on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, I'll have to look into it. I thought I remember seeing an exterior on the space station. I don't know, but on the space shuttle, on the cargo bay, right near the wall, you know, where the windows are, it looks like a manifold, a couple of valves on there where you can tie into it. And seeing close-ups of the suits, you know, diagram, and recharge, you know, recharging connections attached to the suit. I'll have to, you know, go over that. Whether or not they ever used them or not, I don't know, but I thought they did. I would assume that you could repressurize that tank, would you think? I don't know, Dick. I thought that was, I mean, they definitely have some kind of recharging manifold outside. I know it's just not for water or anything. It's for oxygen supply. Whether or not they're doing a tank or no, that's an emergency situation. They're just going to breathe a little bit, bring it back in. No, I don't think so. Thank you.
Yeah, we got to do some more checking on that one. Without a doubt, it's possible if there's a high pressure hose, and I'm guessing the oxygen tank on the spacesuit gets charged to 6,000, 10,000 pounds, some great big number. And can you do that in a space environment? When you're recharging a tank, you're taking high-pressure oxygen for a short period of time. It's going down to a low-pressure as it's when you're doing that in a 14.7 pounds per square inch atmosphere environment, the heat, the convective heat of that atmosphere on that pipe will heat things up during the time it wants to do cooling because expansion is taking place. when you're in space, that convection suction of air situation. I'm a little worried about how you control the temperatures during the recharging operation. Recharging has got all kinds of crazy pressures and temperatures that take place. The good news is that a frozen valve on a spacesuit is not going to frost up in space, but if your hand touches it through the glove, and the glove is very thin, that doesn't sound good. So I think there's a number of dangers involved there. I bet you very little recharging in space has taken place. Do you know of any EVA who has ever used any of that recharging stuff in anything but an emergency procedure? Did any of them ever really do a recharging so that they could extend the EVA? And if a guy is out there 6 or 8 hours, there's a whole lot of reasons why I think he'd want to go back in, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Paul, for a final on this one. WS2M, J2LAW, and the Tech Man.
I thought they had the capability. Whether or not they ever did it or not, I don't know. you know, you told him I sent 1,000. I don't know about that. We had big oxygen tanks they used to use for cutting steel and welding, and those came in at 3,000 PSI. I can't imagine anything more than that.
You're probably right. I just made a guess. So you think a good steel tank can take 3 thou, and 3 thou versus 14.7, that's a ratio of what? Is it 20 to 1 or 200 to 1? Let's see. 14.7 times 10 would be 140. It's a 200 to 1. So in theory, whatever volume the tank is, you've got 200 times more volume when it's running at 3,000 PSI. And so it sounds like the right kind of ratios. 3,000 sounds a lot more reasonable. I'm a little worried. Is the tank that's on the spacesuit, is it really a composite material woven, or is it really a steel tank with all the weight? Got a guess on that one, Paul? Go ahead.
That's probably all titanium, or, you know, built with something. The tank's got to be lightweight. Got to be strong. I don't know if they're aluminum. Could be, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were titanium.
I'd be afraid of it being aluminum because you can only pressurize an aluminum container. Like, for instance, the whole fuselage of an aluminum airplane, you can only pressurize it a given number of times before you have to start inspecting it for cracks of the aluminum fatigue. Aluminum has got a nasty characteristic of no fatigue limit. In other words, when you flex a piece of aluminum, if you do it enough times, no matter how small the deflection is, it eventually crystallizes and starts fracturing. Okay, thank you for the space report, Paul. Let me go back to the other mode of operation, which I'm about to do right now. Okay, we're back to a more normal operation. And one more call for the person who signed in from Georgia. KJ4ILK, if you're there, Rich, go right ahead. K2LIW in the TechNet. And I wondered, did we really properly cover Brian? KC2SGI, Sierra Golf India. If you're still there, Brian, give us a shout. Okay. Of all the people that I listed, did we skip anybody? Did we handle everybody on the list before we go into the more serious stuff? Give me your calls right now, K2LIW. Looks like there's nobody unhappy along those lines.
Hey, Dick.
Hey, go ahead, John.
That ratio wasn't 200. It's more like 2,000 to 1, isn't it?
He did say
KJ4ILKL.
KJ4ILK.
Very fine, Rich. Glad you're back. KJ4ILK. He did say 3,000 pounds. 3,000 pounds couldn't be 2,000 times greater. That would boil down to 1.5 pounds. 14.7 times 2,000 ratio is a 200 ratio. Times 200 ratio would be roughly 3,000 pounds, a little shy of 3,000 pounds. I think the ratio is 200, Paul. But we'll eventually check on that. Rich from Georgia, go right ahead. KJ4, ILK, glad you're still there. K2RAW in the TechNet, my name is Dick.
Yeah, roger that. My repeater ID is kind of long, so it won't let me key up over top of it. So that's why you're saying they inspect more smaller planes more than they do the bigger ones, because the smaller ones tend to have more, I guess, crystallization. Crystallization that could happen to it than a bigger plane, or would they have the same effect no matter what type of aluminum per se would be made out of? KJ Fly, okay.
Yeah, there's a couple of questions and wrapped into your particular question there, Rich. I guess you call yourself a Rich. Ricky. Sorry about that. Any piece of aluminum, and I presume it's true of most of the aluminum alloys, no matter how small the deflection is, if you do it enough times, it may take zillions of times, but if you do it enough times, aluminum will eventually crystallize. It's called the no-fatigue limit characteristic of aluminum. Steel won't do that. If you make the deflection of a piece of steel small enough, you haven't gone beyond the elastic limit, you're in the springy area of the steel, you can do it forever. But aluminum doesn't do that. Now, big versus small aluminum aircraft, is there a difference in the inspection rate? I don't know. But I can see how the larger aircraft would be a little more critical, depending on how it was made, how thin the skin is. Because of the so-called aneurysm effect, I'm going to call it. It's got another fancy name. You know that something that has a rather small cross-section, like the tire on a British bicycle, an English racer bicycle, that tire has a rather small cross-section, and you inflate it to nearly 70 pounds. A larger cross-sectional tire, like the tire on an American bicycle, you only inflate it to 28 pounds. Once you change the diameter of the thing that you're inflating, larger diameters will develop more skin tension, even though the amount of gas pressure inside is smaller. So because of that, I'm going to call it the aneurysm effect, a larger diameter aircraft, in my opinion, has more to worry about when it comes to aluminum fatigue. The amount of stress of the skin for the exact same amount of air pressure inside is, in general, going to be greater. And I could go one step further if you really want to know why that takes place. But it explains why an aneurysm, as a bulging blood vessel somewhere in the human body, is such a dangerous condition. KJ4, ILK, K2RIW. Go ahead, Ricky. My name is Dick.
Yeah, roger that, Dick. I did have another question about the same thing. Is it because that it will crystallize because the water in the air hitting it? Like metal, when rain hits metal, it rusts. Does it do the same sort of same thing as that, or does it do completely different of carbon? I want to say dioxide rusting.
The property of steel is such that as long as you stay below the elastic limit, it has essentially no fatigue mechanism. In the case of aluminum, yes. Aluminum, most of the alloys of aluminum will rather rapidly develop aluminum oxide on the surface. I'm not convinced the aluminum oxide is a major causative action of the crystallization that takes place when you're cyclically deflecting a piece of aluminum. I think the basic aluminum would still crystallize even in a vacuum environment, is my belief. Now, whether or not this process gets speeded up or slowed down by aluminum oxide, that I don't know. But larger diameter objects that are being inflated develop a stronger skin pressure, skin tension happens more rapidly as the diameter increases, even though the air pressure in the same might be the air pressure inside, the fluid pressure might be the same. That's the reason why when you first begin to inflate a child's balloon, It's very difficult to blow it up in the beginning, and near the end when you're over-inflating it by blowing it with your mouth, it's fairly easy to burst it, because as the diameter gets larger, less air pressure is effective. By the same token, when you let go of a balloon and you see it squirting around the room, as the balloon is almost deflating, you'll notice that it moves much more rapidly right at the end. Smaller diameter objects develop a lot less skin tension for the same amount of air pressure. Or conversely, larger diameter objects develop a lot more skin tension for a smaller amount of air pressure. I call that the aneurysm effect. It has a proper name. Maybe it's called the Johnson effect, if you know what I mean. It's got somebody's name attached to it. Over to you, Ricky, KTRIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Now, there is one other question I had, and there's something I wanted to also say. By the way, I did finish making that homemade 2-meter radio, and it works quite nicely, as a matter of fact. I made some contacts on it today. Without going into very much detail, but just enough that I can understand, how does Bernoulli's principle work?
Depending on who you talk to, the answer is not too well. I could send you a beautiful report done by a guy who works at Fermi Laboratory, who used to work at the NASA Langley Research Center of Aeronautics Research, which basically says that we teach the Bernoulli principle as the mechanism by which a wing of an airplane develops lift. For traditional reasons, for approximately 100 years, we have been teaching that principle. I can show you a very well-documented report that says it's almost untrue. That Bernoulli effect for lift of a wing is an extremely minor secondary effect. The majority of a wing, what it does to create lift, is to take this massive substance called air and deflect it downward. So action and reaction of deflecting the air is where the wing develops its lift. And you can tell that right away because you know that there are stunt-type aircraft that have a thoroughly symmetric wing where the airplane can fly upside down or right side up with equal performance. And now to explain that with Bernoulli's principle, let me drop. To use Bernoulli's principle to explain that would be very difficult. I also can take an ordinary airfoil airplane and fly it upside down. Yes, it is less efficient, but still it flies. And where's Bernoulli's principle in that case? Or in the case of water skis, are you going to say that the lift of a water ski, when it's going across the surface of the water, is because the water is moving over the top of the ski and creating a low pressure? Of course it's not. The water ski is deflecting water downward. That's where the lift is coming from. And so this report, which I can refer you, if you tell me your email address, and you don't have to tell me if it's already on QRZ.com, which I'm looking for right now. And no, your email address might not be there. But if you tell me your email address, I could mail you a copy of the address by which you can get a copy of this report, this very well-written report that explains where the lift of a wing is coming from. And I'll warn you, this is a controversial subject. The people who have been taught Bernoulli principle so many times for so many years cannot possibly open up their mind and accept any other possible explanation. So I'll warn you, you may become unpopular, even though you might be thoroughly accurate, if you start preaching this new concept, Ricky. KJ4ILK, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, it's my call, KJ4ILK, at gmail.com. So basically what you're telling me, in a simplified way, is the wing or the plane has to overcome the obstacle of gravity in order to stay in the air, correct?
Oh, without a doubt. You and I could easily come up with a definition of flight And one definition of flight is that the number of pounds of lift that your wing and the rest of the aircraft is generating must be equal to or greater than the mass of the airplane. Gravity is continuously acting on the airplane and pulling it down. You can have an awful lot of fun with your engineering friends by asking them the puzzle of the birds in the truck. Assume a truck is about to drive over a bridge that's rated for 11,000 pounds maximum. The truck weighs 10,000 pounds, and there's 2,000 pounds of birds inside the fully enclosed trailer of the truck. So there's 12,000 pounds of mass there total. And so you ask the person that you're questioning, if all the birds are in flight inside of the truck, and they're in a racetrack pattern midway between the floor and the ceiling, if all the birds are in flight while you drive over the bridge, which the bridge rated for 10,000 pounds, would the bridge, for 11,000 pounds, would the bridge break? And the majority of engineers will say, no problem, because of Bernoulli's principle. And you go a couple of more steps in studying that problem, and you realize that even though the birds are all in flight, that bridge would collapse with 2,000 pounds of birds in a 10,000-pound truck with an 11,000-pound rated bridge. So you can slowly convince your friends that Bernoulli's principle doesn't really give you the whole story. It gives you very little of the story once I mail you a copy of this report. Over to you, Ricky, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, and the other thing I wanted to ask you that wasn't about that now is I have a couple of HPs here that work, and I want to interface from the Echolink. How do I do this?
You're going to have to ask somebody who is much more informed than I am on Echolink. By the way, you said you built a pair of 2-meter rigs. Were these handy-talkie 2-meter kits? That wasn't clear. You may have told us 1 or 2 weeks ago, and I'm a bit forgetful, so the 2-meter rigs that you constructed yourself, that you tested today, and they work very well, tell me, what were they? What did you construct that you tested today, Ricky? Back to you, K2RIW.
They weren't kits. I completely homebrewed them, over. One for... It covers the whole 2-meter band, basically. FM and sideband. The other one is FM, DW, and sideband.
It sounds like you built a pair. But let's just go to the FM and sideband rig. If you built a thoroughly homebrew, frequency-synthesized, 2-meter transceiver, transmitter receiver that operates from 144 to 148 megacycles, both in the sideband mode and the FM mode, and thoroughly homebrew, that's an extremely unusual endeavor. The number of hams in the United States that are likely to do that, even though there's 600,000 hams in the United States, I think the number of guys that are likely to do that, I could count them on one hand. So is it somebody's very highly integrated integrated chip set that you use to do this? Give us a couple of more words. To homebrew, to scratch built, so to speak, a 2-meter sideband FM transceiver. Very unusual, if that's what you're saying, Ricky. In which case, pat yourself on the back. You're in a very rare group of people. KJ4ILK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I didn't quite understand, but I'm guessing you're saying, did I use someone else's thing? I'm guessing if you meant that. Some of it was from old other junk radios. Next project I'm going to try, and I've actually never worked with this, but vacuum tubes. I have never tried vacuum tubes. I'm not going to put more than 3 in, because, of course, I don't know how to install them. But I guess with my friend who lives up the road a little bit, he can probably teach me. Actually, you may know him. KC2SEO. His name is Drew. He used to live in New Jersey.
I don't think I know Drew, but now you said something that makes it a little bit more understandable. I think you said you took a number of other 2-meter rigs and combined various portions. So maybe you did what the Air Force called cannibalizing. Did you cannibalize, take a synthesizer out of one and an amplifier out of another? Did you take other 2-meter rigs and combine the good portions of various ones to make up this 2-meter sideband FM transceiver? Is that what you're saying you did, Ricky? If so, that's a little bit more understandable. But at first you made it sound like you took integrated circuits and discrete transistors and built up a completely unique design. I'm going to call it a symbol, S-I-M-B-L-E, a symbol design. You made it sound like a completely unique symbol design, which is his last name, is what you constructed. And I'm beginning to think it might have been a little bit more like cannibalizing. Back to you, Ricky, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, that's exactly what I did with it. Took a little of this, a little of that, and boom, I have something thrown together.
Okay. What made you do that as opposed to taking any one of those rigs and repairing what was not working? What made you not repair one of those rigs as is? Go ahead.
Some of them cost too much, and I found out that it would actually be cheaper to take them and throw it into one rig. The other one actually works simultaneously with the one that I'm using now. So if I put one on one, I can hook them together and transmit on two bands with one microphone.
Okay, of the rig that you constructed, is that what you're using to talk to me right now, or you're talking to me with another rig? Over to you, Ricky.
Yeah, Roger, I'm talking to you on it right now. How does it sound?
Sounds amazingly good. Had you not told me, I would have never known. Okay, Ricky, we run this TechNet each Sunday night, and we usually have quite a number of people asking questions and answers, and try to get answers. So I'm going to move on to our next person. Awful glad you signed in, and looking forward to talking to you again in the future. John, KC2WGB, of all of the emails that you and I have gotten today from Wesley, one of them, I only got a chance to see portions of a couple of them. One of them is a rotary machine where the guy can run it on 50 hertz or 100 hertz. It spins at either 3,000 RPM or 6,000 RPM. It has a whole bunch of neodymium magnets. That's one of them. Another one is the what I think is a parametric amplifier. Make a choice, John, if you can, as to which one you think we should discuss, because you probably looked at them with more diligence than I have so far. I've had some company over my house today. Didn't get a chance to spend very much time on them.
One thing, 760 Lenkert is just a curiosity device that I have purchased. I made a complete documentation with a short video on it. So maybe this first, and then we go to the neodymium stuff, which is actually a continuation of the NASA. It's the same guy, but a few years before, he made a presentation, and to HGS.
Mr. Leo, did you talk for a real quick question, if possible?
Now, one of those emails, one of those YouTube videos, one of the videos you showed me was a pair of switches on a box. One of the boxes goes from 20 hertz to 10 megacycles. The other one goes from some other frequency range. Beautiful, extremely flat passband response is the graph on the front of the box. Is that one of the things that you either built or purchased? Or which is that, Wesley? Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick, we could discuss that. That's a balance.
You're saying that is a balance, okay? In other words, it's got a single pole double throw switch on the left, a single pole double throw, no, double pole. Double pole double throw switch on the left and on the right, which means you can thoroughly bypass the upper filter and go to the lower filter or vice versa. I'm not quite sure. That it looks like it's a bandpass filter. It's two different bandpass filters, and you can choose whichever one you want to use at that instant of time.
But Marty also informed you via the same email with the pictures.
Dick, if you look at it, you've got a single-ended input on balanced in, balanced out, 124 ohms out. And we were talking to George IKT. That's used in the telecom industry, and I've seen that used on aircraft for carrier multiplexing on audio lines, like for the phone company. And you're right, there's a filter. It's a combination of things, but it's a balance on balance match if you look at it closely.
So it is a balancing device, is what you're saying. It's a balancing device. And was that the latest email or the second of the latest or the third email? Which one was that, John?
I believe that was second to the last.
Yes, not the one with the biology of the RCA Club. It's the one which has got NASA video. Let's see now.
The one that the title on it is subject for detected number 2. What is Lankert 760 Test Transformer USA Army? Subject for the TechNet was March 23rd. Subject for the TechNet number 2. What is Lankert 760 Test Transformer USA Army?
Dick, while you're checking that, that parametric amplifier that you're looking at, I saw a device like that on a horn antenna once, twice actually, on a job. And that was at a military base. What it's used for, I have no idea, but you could be close on that one.
Okay, I found the TechNet number 2. My machine's a little bit slow in responding tonight. And, okay, there's a whole series of pictures here, four pictures. And I believe the middle, the second picture, I think, is the one that shows me the Galen with the schematic diagram. Yes, there it is. 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz or 20 kilohertz to 10 megahertz. So because it has a grounded input on the left side and a shielded twin lead coming out of the right side, Lankert. So I guess this is a recent purchase of yours, the 760A test transformer. And so and it says 175 ohm input, 124 ohm output. Interesting. So it's converting impedance. And it's also a balancing filter assembly. Interesting. I guess who's going to discuss this and what should we say about it? I don't know who should pick it up, John or Wesley. I'll stand by. KQRAW.
Pick up John, because we spent a few hours discussing that. What is interesting in this device is a transformer. Imagine, I created a video, actually two sets of videos, but one was the latest version, and you have a link for it. So basically what you do is you click on it. You don't have to look at everything, just from the half, the last half of the video down. The video is 10 minutes long, so it would be like 5 minutes. We don't have that much time. But they created a transformer that was able to transfer a frequency from very low to 20 kilohertz. I assume the other one, which was much smaller, was to 10 megahertz. Anyhow, John, pick up.
Yeah, what I'm seeing here is the schematic diagram, the fourth picture, is these two separate transformers, and they've got capacitors on the primary and on the secondary, and I see a very precise RC network on the input of each one, which I guess is carefully adjusting the impedance. The transformer itself is what gives you the completely floating, balanced-like output.